This is a recording from the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society, brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Find out more about what we do at cvillepodcast.com. On Friday, November 7, 2008, Professor Brian Kaplan addressed the Jefferson Society. Dr. Kaplan is an associate professor of economics at George Mason University and author of The Myth of the Rational Voter. He is introduced by Jefferson Society Vice President Bailey Barfield.
All right, thank you guys so much for coming out tonight. This is an incredible turnout, and I'm very pleased and proud to announce our next speaker in the Fall 2008 Speaker Series roster, Professor Brian Kaplan. Brian Kaplan is an associate professor of economics at George Mason in Fairfax, Virginia. He received his bachelor's in economics from the University of California at Berkeley and his PhD from Princeton University. His professional work has been devoted to the philosophies of libertarianism and free market capitalism and anarchism. He is the author of the famous Anarchist Theory, Frequently Asked Questions. He has published in American Economic Review, Public Choice, and the Journal of Law and Economics, among others. He is a blogger at EconLaw, along with Arnold Kling, and occasionally has been a guest blogger at Marginal Revolution with two of his colleagues at George Mason, Tyler Cohen and Alex Tabaroff. He is an adjunct scholar of the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. Currently, his primary research is in public economics. He has criticized the assumption of rational voters that form the basis of public choice theory, but generally agrees with their conclusions based on his own model of rational irrationality. Kaplan's book on his theme, The Myth of the Rational Voter, is a response to the arguments put forward by economist Donald Whitman in his The Myth of the Democratic Failure. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, I present to you Professor Brian Kaplan.
Thank you, Bailey. Thank you. Thank you for my first standing ovation. I've never gotten one before, and I didn't even have to talk. All right, so hopefully I will deserve your standing ovation. All right, so basically what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about my book, The Myth of the Rational Voter. I usually talk very quickly, and since I only have 40 minutes, mostly I'm just going to try to say less, but I may accidentally speed up a little bit more. So if I am talking really fast, just stop me. Okay, so starting with what's called the miracle aggregation. Now, if you were to go over to people in your political science department who actually know something about what voters are like, and you were to say, and I wave my book in their face and say, hey, this book shows that you're all wrong, and this book shows that voters don't know very much about politics or policy, they'd probably say, well, that's been well known for decades. I don't see anything new about this book. However, why are you snapping your fingers? Okay. All right, so if you were to go and ask them, you know, so what is new about this? They say, well, I don't know, what is new about it? Well, here's the interesting thing. While it is very common among people who work in public opinion to say that voters know very little about politics and policy, it is also very common to deny that it makes any difference, to say that it doesn't make any difference if the American voter knows what he's doing, which seems like a pretty strange and counterintuitive conclusion. Because, you know, so if you were talking to your surgeon and he said, hey, I'm going to cut you open, I'm going to reach around and find something wrong and chop at it a bit and sew you up, you'll be fine, you would probably be nervous if he didn't understand basic anatomy. You'd probably be concerned and say, should I allow someone to operate on me when he doesn't seem to understand what he's doing? All right. So you may say the same thing about democracy and say, how could it work very well if voters had no clue about what was going on? Well, it turns out there is actually a nice, simple, clean story, and it goes under the heading of the miracle of aggregation, and the story is something like this. Suppose the people who don't know what's going on just flip a coin, okay, which seems reasonable. If you don't know what you're doing, then maybe you could just flip a coin to decide what to do. What would happen? Well, I suppose 90% of people knew absolutely nothing, and just to make the comparison interesting, suppose the other 10% know everything. So they're like walking Wikipedias. They're walking edited Wikipedias, so they have all the information that's actually fact-checked. All right, now you go and you talk to people on election day who are waiting in line, and you would be disturbed to find that 90% of people don't know anything at all. Right? They don't even know what country they're in. Right? So they know zero. Then you talk to one person out of 10 and say, hey, this one person out of 10 is really remarkable. One person in 10 is a genius. Unfortunately, it's a democracy, and those 10% of people are not actually deciding what happens. Okay? Well, turns out that as long as those 90% of people don't know anything, just flip a coin, those remaining 10% who know everything are much more efficacious than you might realize. Because here's the thing, as long as the electorate is reasonably large, then there is something that statisticians call the law of large numbers that says that the percentage of for a reasonably large number of coin flips, the percentage that will be heads, the percentage that will be tails, will be about 50%. Okay, very close. And as the number gets larger, you will get even closer to having a 50-50 split. So out of those 90% of people who basically know nothing, if they flip a coin, then it's going to turn out that 45% of them will vote for one candidate, 45% will vote for the other candidate. So far, you may be pretty nervous, right? Because it could be an election between, say, Adolf Hitler and Joe Blow. And then you said, wow, 45% of people are voting for Hitler. It's kind of scary, right? But then we find out what's going to happen with the remaining 10%. Well, let's just assume that the remaining 10% would not vote for Hitler. Okay, so you're really informed, you're not going to vote for this guy? No. All right, so how could I? I understand what's going on. All right, so these remaining 10%, who are, of course, just one person out of 10, nevertheless, if these people are going to vote for Joe Blow rather than Adolf Hitler, then all 10 percentage points of the informed vote is going to go over to the least less objectionable candidate. So what happens is that the less objectionable candidate wins. He gets 55% of the vote. And this actually is not a Jerry Reed example. This example actually illustrates a very general point, which is that under these assumptions, under the assumption that people who don't know what they're doing flip a coin, then in order to win, you need to have the support of the majority of the well-informed. Right? The crucial thing is whether or not you have the support of the majority of the well-informed, and if you get that, you win. And that's interesting because suppose that everyone were well-informed. Then what would we need to win? A support of the majority of the well-informed. So it turns out that even if only one person out of 10 is well-informed, nevertheless, they are the ones that decide the outcome. Okay? And this is the story that allows political scientists to sleep well at night. Because they look at the data, they say, my God, people know very little. They'd probably say it's not 90% know zero, but on the other hand, it's also not 10% know everything. So it's unrealistic on both ends. But so nevertheless, they look at the data and say, wow, things look pretty grim. But then you tell the story and say, all right, we can now rest easy. It just doesn't make any difference that most people don't know what's going on. It doesn't matter. It turns out the people who are in charge are actually well-informed, and the other people just cancel each other out. Okay, and this result has been called the miracle aggregation. It's been called a miracle because it seems miraculous, right? This is like medieval alchemy. This is like we have 90% lead, 10% gold. We stir it around. We put a cloth on top of it. We say some magic words, and then it's 24 karat gold. Okay, and this is the same thing. So we have a people that is 90% completely uninformed. We put in a few drops of people who are walking Wikipedias. We stir it around, we say some magic words, and we get exactly the same result that we would have had if everyone were fully informed. Okay, so, but of course, this is not magic. This actually does follow quite clearly from the assumptions. Right, so as long as the assumptions are true, this conclusion does, in fact, follow. Okay, now, what the miracle does is it gives people a way to believe in democracy and the facts at the same time. Right, so like walking and chewing gum at the same time, it allows people to first acknowledge the plain facts, which is that people have very little knowledge about what's going on. On the other hand, they can also say, but democracy works anyway, so stop worrying. Okay, so is everybody with me so far? All right, good. Okay, so now this brings me to one of my favorite sayings, which if it seems too good to be true, it probably is. Has anyone here watched late night television? Yes, and anyone ever seen that you too can start your own alpaca farm? Yes, these wonderful animals, they're gentle, they have beautiful fleece. For a few $1,000, we will send you an alpaca, and you can raise them in your own backyard. And pretty soon, you too will be mailing other people the alpacas that you have been breeding in your farm, in your backyard, and you're going to be rich beyond your wildest dreams, and you can do this in like 5 spare minutes a day. Okay, so anyone seen this commercial? Right. Yeah, so this is why I'm not worried about driving back after this to Northern Virginia, is that I stay up very late every night, and normally I don't watch the alpaca ads, but I have seen them a number of times. Okay, so now I will say I've never actually double-checked any of the facts about the alpaca farms. I have never investigated this question to double-check. Maybe I could get rich in alpaca farming. I just look at these ads and say, if it seems too good to be true, it probably is, and this really does seem too good to be true. What are the odds that me, a man who has never done anything on a farm at all, would be able to open up a profitable alpaca farm in his backyard? Seems to be very difficult to believe. Okay. Now, this brings me to this key assumption of the miracle aggregation, which is that voter errors are random rather than systematic, that the people don't know very much, just flip a coin. And when I first began researching this, I said, all right, well, this is a very widely shared assumption, so there's got to be at least some semi-plausible evidence this is true. So I started looking around in literature, and I was amazed at how little I found. It's an assumption that sounds good, but in terms of actually double-checking against the facts, almost nothing has been done. Right? So, and when I went and talked to other economists, turned out the main argument was just that it would be irrational if people who didn't know anything didn't flip a coin to decide what to believe. Look, if you haven't researched it, why would you do anything other than flip a coin? Therefore, that's got to be what people do. I say, that seems like a real leap of faith. I mean, wouldn't you want to double-check this? It really seems like you might. And then when I went over to political scientists and asked them, right, so why do you guys believe this? I would often get the deer in the headlights look as they would look at me and say, we believe it because you economists told us it was true, and now you're asking us why we believe it? Yes, I'm asking you. Oh, my God. All right, so they took our word for it and turned out that we actually had basically just made it up. All right, so, of course, the fact that a fact has never been checked does not show the fact is wrong, right? So after finding that there was very little existing literature showing that any of this was true, started looking around and saying, so how could we actually find out whether or not it was true? Well, it turns out when you do look at public opinion data, there is strong evidence that large systematic errors are the rule rather than the exception. So systematic as opposed to random. So rather than it just being a 50-50 split, instead there's a tendency for people who don't know very much to believe one particular conclusion rather than the other. All right, now, there's three main ways that you can go and test voter beliefs for systematic error. Or again, you could test them to see whether or not they really are random. Okay, so I don't have that much time, so I'm going to go through them very quickly. All right, so method number one is the most straightforward. It says step one, find out what the fact is. Step two, ask people what they think the fact is. Step three, see whether the average public's average belief about the fact equals the truth. Okay, so you can go and to the Statistical Abstract of the United States, say what percentage of the budget is spent on foreign aid. The answer is 1.2%. Then you go and ask people what percentage of the budget do you think is spent on foreign aid. You go and you collect all their answers. You take the average and you see if that equals 1.2%. Or, you know, more strictly speaking, you do a statistical test to see whether they are equal. Right? You wouldn't expect them to be equal to the small to 10 decimal places, but still see, is it like 1.1 and 1.2? All right, in that case, maybe it really is true the public's average error is zero. Okay. Now, when you go and apply this method, very large systematic errors are extremely easy to find. Turns out, for example, in the federal budget, there are a number of items that the public grossly overestimates. Right? So the public greatly overestimates the amount of money we spend on foreign aid, greatly overestimates the amount of money we spend on welfare, and on the other hand, greatly underestimates the amount of money we spend on Social Security and greatly underestimates the amount of money that we spend on healthcare. Okay, so these are just a few examples, but these are big examples. The public is deeply confused about where our money goes. In fact, they are so confused that in one very prominent and high-quality survey done by the Kaiser Family Foundation, they gave people a choice. They say, look, here's six different items of spending. Which two do you think are the biggest in the budget? Foreign aid was the most common answer. It was the number one most popular answer, even though it's about 1.2% of the budget. Okay, so these are not just small errors. These are very large errors on questions of considerable importance. Now, the main problem with this method is that most interesting questions are not so cut and dried. Most interesting questions can't be answered by just going to the Statistical Abstract of the United States. You can't go to the page on free trade and say, what is the best policy for economic development, free trade or protection, and then answer, free trade. All right, so generally, you will not see answers like that in a basic reference manual. Doesn't mean they're not right or wrong answers, just that the answers are a bit more ambiguous than that. Okay. So what can you do for questions that are not so cut and dried? Well, there's one method that is widely used in political science. This is called the enlightened preference approach. This is probably the most complicated thing that I'll say, so I don't have enough time to repeat it, but I'll do it. But I'll try to do it clearly once. All right. So here's what you do if you want to apply the enlightened preference method. Step one is you give people a test of their objective political knowledge. So in other words, this is like a political IQ test. So you have questions like how many senators does each state have, how many states are there in the country, name as many Supreme Court justices as you can, so you get their knowledge about basic factual questions that you can score and give people a grade. All right, then step to part two is you go and ask people about their policy preferences. So should pro-choice or pro-life, invade Iraq, not invade Iraq, raise taxes, don't raise taxes, privatize Social Security, don't privatize it. So you get a whole bunch of their views about policy. And then finally, you get a lot of information about different characteristics that might affect people's views about policy, holding their knowledge constant. Okay, so now we've got three kinds of information. We know people's political knowledge, we know their policy preferences, and we know their non-cognitive characteristics. All right, so then what you do in the enlightened preference method is you estimate people's preferences as a function of all their characteristics and their knowledge. Okay, so again, this is applying some very basic statistics, but all what you're doing is statistically estimating what people's preferences are as a function of their characteristics and their knowledge. And then here's the trick. Right, once we know this, we can then go and simulate what people would believe if they got a perfect score on that political IQ test. And what we're doing essentially is we are saying, look, if we take people who are similar in every other way, but they differ in their political IQ, right? So they're similar in every respect except some people know more about politics than others. Let us assume that if we were to raise people's political IQ score up to a higher level, they would think like people who are just like them except they know more. Okay, so that's the idea. All right, now if the miracle aggregation were right, essentially political IQ wouldn't make any difference. Right, because people who didn't know very much would, on average, think exactly the same thing that otherwise similar people thought who had high scores. In fact, it does not work out that way. In fact, on almost any issue you consider, there are substantial knowledge effects. So there's a very good book by Scott Aldhouse called Collective Preferences in Democratic Politics, where he goes over everything that's ever been done on this subject. And the punchline is that you see large effects of knowledge on almost every question. Right? So, just to give you an example of what you wind up getting with this approach. There's one question that Aldhouse talks about, and the survey said this. Which of the following two positions is closer to your view? Quote, one, we need a strong government to handle today's complex economic problems, or two, the free market to handle these problems without government becoming involved, end quote. So if you look at the actual breakdown for real public opinion, so what people really said, 62% went with strong government and 38% went with the free market. However, if you go and apply the enlightened preference approach and see what would people think if they got the perfect score on the political IQ test, then the estimated breakdown shifts so that you'd only have 47% saying strong government, 53% saying free markets. Okay, so this is just one example. There's many others. You can see things like on abortion, for example. Right, so an abortion informed opinion is more pro-choice than uninformed opinion. Okay, which you may say, isn't this just a values question? It's probably not just a values question. You know, someone who has a more understanding might think about how exactly do we propose to make abortion illegal? Right? What will the punishments be and who will be punished? Which is a serious question. Okay, so that's the enlightened preference approach. A third method, which is the main one that I use in my book, is what is called the method of layman-expert comparison. The assumption here is that all else equal, if laymen and experts disagree about a question that is within the expert's field of expertise, the expert is probably right and the laymen are probably wrong. Okay, so this is an admittedly elitist assumption. Although it is only a presumption, the method is open to the possibility that experts might actually have their own agenda, for example. Just saying that all else equal, if there is a disagreement between laymen and the public, laymen and experts, that the experts are probably the ones who are correct. Okay. Now, just to back up, you may say, well, can you always trust the experts? No, of course not. So you go to a mechanic and you ask him what's wrong with your car, and he said, what's wrong with it is you need to pay me $5,000 to fix it. Okay, and if you say, I don't know if I can trust you, he might say, pull the expert card and say, hey, how can you trust me? I've been doing this for 20 years. What do you know about cars? Well, on the one hand, not very much. On the other hand, I do know that it is in your interest to convince me that I need to spend $5,000 to fix a car, even if I don't really need to do that. Okay, so there are definitely cases where it is reasonable to distrust experts when their interests conflict with yours. But suppose you talk to an expert who knew he was not going to get your business. That's a case where it starts to seem a bit strange and arrogant to say, what do you know? Well, I've been doing this for 20 years, and I know I'm not going to get your business. Why would I lie to you? And then if, say, the mechanic is your son, says, look, Mom, you need to do this or your car will explode. What do you know? Well, and how could I trust you? You didn't abuse me. Why would I lie? I have your best interest at heart, Mom. I'm just trying to help you. That's all I'm trying to do. So it seems like when you get to a case where the expert has no incentive to lie, at least starts to seem a bit paranoid and arrogant to say that, nevertheless, the expert, you can't really trust the expert and the layman is rather to be believed. Okay, now, also mention that there is a very funny book called The Expert Speak, which is basically a giant dictionary of every stupid thing an expert has ever said about anything. All right, and it is a funny book. So you have things like the president of IBM in the 50s saying, I think there's a world market for about 5 computers. And lots of things along these lines. However, here's the key thing to realize. There isn't any book called the non-expert speak, where you go and have a dictionary about every stupid thing non-experts have ever said. Because it would just be too, it would be so easy it wouldn't even be funny. Right? You'd have to have really stupid things said by the public in order to get a laugh. Because look, you know, a person who doesn't know anything about physics goes and says some stuff about physics and it's crazy, but what does that prove? All right? It's not very much. So the reason why the expert speak is funny is because we all do share a presumption that normally the experts are correct, even if, of course, they are not infallible, which I would never say. Right? Because I disagree with experts myself sometimes, so only I can be infallible. No. Not even me. No. Okay. So it turns out that when you apply this method of comparing the views of laymen and experts, there are large disagreements between laymen and experts on important questions, and these include something that is near and dear to my heart, the subject of economics. Okay, now, just to give you some background, you may say, well, what's so great about economics? You're an economist. Is it interesting to you? Why should it be interesting to anybody else? Say, actually, economics is not just interesting to economists. In general, if you poll the American public and ask them what is the most important question facing the country, the number one answer is almost always the economy. Basically, the only exceptions were 2001, 2002, 2003. Then often terrorism or Iraq or foreign policy beat economics. But now we're back into the normal state of affairs where most people say that economics is the most important issue facing the country. So it's not just economists that consider this an important subject. All right, so that's part of it. Something else that's kind of interesting is that economists have a long history of complaining about the public and saying the crazy things the public thinks about our field. It just makes me sick. So you can go back to read Adam Smith. He doesn't quite say it makes me sick, but he says the 18th century genteel version of my students are so aggravating, I can't believe they think this stuff. Okay, now, this is different from what, say, physics professors may say about their students. So physicists may say the students know nothing about physics. But economists actually say something else, which is the students show up and claim to have all the answers. Right? So you can go, first day of Econ 1, a student raises his hand and saying, look, professor, you economists think the trade with China is good, but you have to understand this is a foreign country and they are trying to undermine our economy. Right? And the professor may say, look, I'm just trying to take role here. Let's just delay this for a little bit. Yes, or another example, I can't tell you how many times my dad has told me the solution to all the problems that ail the economy. And yes, two solutions will solve everything. First one is a Berlin Wall at the Mexican border. And the second thing is a naval blockade of Japan. Or actually, the blockade now has to be expanded to China and I think just all of Asia, just to be safe. You never know what bad thing will come out of Asia, so just blockade the continent and we'll be fine. Right? And My dad, it's not that he has read the textbook and has discovered some subtle error in what the textbook says. My dad has no idea what's in the textbook, wouldn't have any ability to tell you what's in there, but nevertheless, and it's not that he's read other books, anything like that. He just knows that these are the solutions for all the problems, even though he's never really taken a class on the subject. So someone will explain the finger snapping to me eventually. Yes. Yes.
We'll do it during
Q&A. Okay. All right. Okay, great. All right. Now, when you put these two facts together, one, that economics is actually widely considered to be very important. Two, that economists have at least been complaining that the public has deep misconceptions about the subject, which sound a lot like systematic errors, suggests that it would be valuable to test the public's beliefs about economics for systematic error. So it turns out there is at least a fairly substantial literature that tries to do this. The main problem is that they basically never asked economists and the public the same questions. So there's a lot of surveys about what the public thinks about how the economy works. There's a bunch of surveys about what economists think about how the economy works. But there's almost none that ask them the same questions, which means you can always say, well, how do we know if they really disagree? You ask the question one way, you get one answer. You ask the question another way, you get another answer. Who knows? All right, now, fortunately for me, there was one very high-quality survey that was done by some other people, and then they gave it to me for free. So the survey, it was called the Survey of Americans and Economists on the Economy. The explicit design of the survey was to ask both the general American public and professional economists exactly the same questions about how the economy works, and to get a wide variety of questions into the survey. Okay, so done in 1996 by the Kaiser Family Foundation, Washington Post, and Harvard University Survey Project. So once again, giving me the added benefit of being able to say, look, I didn't come up with this survey. Those guys came up with the survey. I'm just using it. Right? And, thank you for sharing. Okay. Yes, and this is one of my standard pieces of advice to graduate students is, find some data that other people created but didn't use, and then get them to give it to you. All right. So using this data, we can go and test whether the average beliefs of the general American public and economists are the same. And of course, I wouldn't be here if the answer were yes, or at least I would be presenting a different book. I would be presenting the book saying, everything's, you know, don't worry, be happy, everything's fine. Okay. All right, so do layman experts have the same beliefs about how the economy works as the miracle algorithm predicts? The answer is no. There are very large belief gaps between economists and non-economists. Very often you'll see economists thinking one thing and the general public thinking virtually the opposite. And these gaps are also in the expected directions. They're in the directions that teachers of introductory economics would have expected based upon their frustration with their students. So to give you the very quick version, what are the general patterns of the data? One of them is what I call anti-market bias. So the public tends to underestimate the social benefits of the market mechanism, which basically means that because people in markets are greedy and are out for themselves, and that's clearly true, the public tends to assume that the social consequences must be bad. Right? Whereas economists are saying, wait, hold on, that doesn't follow at all. If the way to make money is to make the customer happy, then the fact that people in business are selfish is actually going to lead to good results rather than bad. Right? So for economists, the interesting question is, what is the way to make money? Right? If the way to make money is actually to make the customer happy, then there isn't really anything to worry about. You should start worrying when you say, how can someone make money by solving this problem? And then you say, can't think of any way to make money. How can someone make money by cleaning up the air? Can't think of any way. That's when economists start to worry. Okay, so, just one example of this that I thought about, or actually that I was inspired by, the last time I was driving down to the UVA at 7 in the morning, is I went and I saw about 7 miles worth of congestion on the other side of the highway. And I drove by this very happy, because I wasn't on that side of the traffic. And then I was thinking to myself, you know what, this is a problem that every economist in the country knows how to solve. Every economist in the country knows how to get rid of this congestion. And that is to stop making rush hour driving free. Raise the price of driving during rush hour, and then you will not have 7 miles of congestion. Seems like a pretty simple solution, and yet one that almost always meets with violent public resistance, because the idea that by raising the price of something that you could actually benefit the people who are paying the price is very hard for people to get. So, look, you're just after my money. Well, even if I were, it would still benefit you. Right? Even if I were, it would still benefit you not be waiting for hours in traffic. Okay, so that is just one. Let's see. In the Q&A, we may be able to talk about some others. Another big bias that we see in the data is what I call anti-foreign bias. So people become especially paranoid whenever foreigners enter the picture. Right? So it's one thing to say that when two Americans trade with each other, they're probably both better off. But what if it's an American and a Chinese? This is when people become very agitated. Start saying, look, you know, how do we know what they're after here? What is that Toyota dealership planning on doing to us? Right? So you can see this on questions involving international trade, questions involving immigration, like questions involving foreign aid. So foreign aid, a very tiny part of the budget, and yet many people convince themselves that foreigners are bleeding us dry. Okay, so another strong tendency in the data. Another one that you notice is what I call make-work bias. So basically people tend to evaluate economic performance based upon employment rather than production, which seems very natural in the short run, because you say, you know, isn't it bad when people lose their jobs? But here's the thing. If you were to go back to 1850 and try to preserve the jobs of farmers from advances in technology, what would have happened to us? Well, nothing. We'd still be farmers. Right, so we'd still be stuck farming. We wouldn't be here. We would be tired from a long day's farming. The reason why the modern world exists is because a whole bunch of people lost their jobs. Right, so we figured out ways of doing more with less, which freed up labor to do other things. And at the time, if an economist had said, well, all those unemployed farmers will do something else, people would have been very upset and say, what? What else are they going to do? Right, and in which case, the honest answer would be, if I knew that, I wouldn't be lecturing about economics. I would be making money by employing people in the next thing they're going to do. So, however, the vague but honest answer of I don't know, but it's going to be something, turns out to be right every time. So every time we figure out a way of doing more with fewer people, we wind up taking that valuable labor and doing something else with it. So when I was growing up in Southern California, there was massive employment in the defense sector. Of course, with the end of the Cold War, there was a lot of job loss. I go back there 10 years later, and what are all the people who would have been in the defense sector doing? Building the internet, right, which of course wouldn't have occurred to anyone at the time. Like, we're going to build an internet. And certainly in 1850, no one would have said people would build the internet in their spare time. So. All right, and a last big bias that you see in the data is what I call pessimistic bias. It's the belief that the world is in decline, is bad now, and is going to get worse. Of course, right now you may say this is no bias. I will say actually it is a bias, and based upon the numbers that we have, things are really not that bad right now. Unless you invested a lot of money in the stock market, then you're... However, in terms of the actual performance of the economy, right, unemployment is 6.1%. That's about average for the last 30 years. We still have not had any decline in real output. Right? For all we know, things are not going to get all that bad. And if you go and just compare, what are other recessions like? Well, you know, the last one in the early 1990s, unemployment peaked at 8.1%, and that was generally considered a very mild recession. Right? So we're still 2 percentage points below the peak of the last really mild recession, and yet I hear many people, including a few of my colleagues, saying the sky is falling. So I say, no, you too can be subject to pessimistic bias. In general, the older I get, the harder it is for me to understand pessimistic bias, because I can actually remember what the world was like 20 years ago now, and it was terrible. So when I was growing up in Southern California, there's no internet. I mean, what is a young nerd to do in the 1980s? I sat around reading books about Dungeons and Dragons because there's no one to talk to about the books. I felt so alone. And now no nerd in the country has to feel this way. Now no one with any interest that you can express in words has any reason to feel lonely. All right, so it's an enormous change, and this is just scratching the surface of all the wonderful things that have happened that we owe to the internet. I still often have to remind myself of the slogan, use the internet to solve this problem. Even now, because I grew up in a period without the internet, I'll often spend an hour trying to think of some non-internet solution before I realize, wait, I should Google this. Oh, yes. Why didn't I could order this from Amazon.com and it would work. All right. So yes, things, and that's just one area. So if you look at the culinary options available in the 1980s, yes, there was America. There were American restaurants, which were horrible, and Italian, Chinese. That was about it. That's all we had back then. Now that would be considered bad in the smallest town in Virginia. Smallest town in Virginia, you could probably find some kebab or something. So you'd still be better off than what we had back then. All right. Now, of course, there's the question of couldn't it be the experts who are biased? And absolutely, it is certainly possible that experts are biased. Sometimes experts are biased. However, just saying the experts are biased is not very helpful. You really need to go and say something specific. You can't trust these economists because of this reason. All right. So if you go and read the critics of the economics profession, and we are a profession that is blessed with many critics, there are two main complaints they have about us. One of them is what's called self-serving bias. It says, look, economists are rich, they got tenure, and they imagine that whatever is good for them is good for the world. Okay? So that is a serious story. Right? Another one that you'll often hear is ideological bias. It says, look, economists are a bunch of right-wing ideologues, so of course they think all this stuff about how we should put tolls during peak hour of the highway. Okay. All right, so these claims are, fortunately for me, specific enough that it is actually possible to test them. And again, in statistical terms, what you're looking at, if someone says the reason why economists think this stuff is because they have high income, then what you want to do is say, look, let's go and compare high income economists to high-income non-economists and see if they agree. Like I said, the explanation is really income, then that actually has a prediction. It says that if two people have the same income, their economic training won't make a difference. Okay, similarly, if you say the reason why economists think this is because they're very right-wing, all right, let's go and find a non-right-wing economist, see what he thinks. Let's go and ask Paul Krugman, see what he thinks about this. Okay. So if you go and apply these tests, and again, it's very easy to do this because all the data is in the data set, both theories fail the most basic tests. So if you go and put in statistical controls for income, job security, past income growth, expected income growth, race, sex, age, some other things, at most this leaves at least 80% of the belief gap intact. So at an absolute upper bound, you can get rid of 20% of a very large belief gap by adding in all these adjustments. And if you look more closely, even that is probably an overstatement, because very often the sign is wrong. Like, for example, economists are less worried about the effect of welfare on the economy than most people, although I don't know of any economists on welfare. Certainly no PhD economists on welfare. Okay, so if it were self-serving bias, you'd expect that they would be saying, hey, I'm never going to be on welfare, therefore it's terrible. That's not how it works. Okay, so oftentimes the signs are wrong for self-interest to be the story. If you go and look at the ideological bias story, so here you can go and correct for the party identification of people as well as the ideology they say they have, very liberal, liberal, moderate, conservative, very conservative. If you go and apply this test, it turns out the belief gap between economists and the public actually gets bigger because it's not true that economists are right-wing. Right now, if you hang around George Mason long enough, you'll be forgiven for believing this. But, but if you go to the American Economic Association and meet normal economists, you will learn the truth that the typical economist is a moderate Democrat. He's a moderate Democrat who thinks that downsizing is good, that international trade is good, that price of oil is determined by supply and demand. So he thinks all these things that are commonly believed to be right-wing views, However, he believes them not because he's right-wing, but despite the fact that he's not. Right? So, and if you go and read Paul Krugman's earlier writings back when he focused more on economics, he said many things that would horrify the people who now read his column. Let's put it that way. All right. So, you know, for example, you go and read his book, The Accidental Theorist. There's a number of very interesting claims in there, such as European unemployment is caused by labor market regulation, and globalization protesters are the enemies of mankind. All right. Yes. Well-meaning, but still they're enemies. All right. Still, well, our enemies, right? Because we are mankind. Okay. All right. So anyway, so you can go and do these controls and see that actually the standard stories about why economists are not to be trusted don't work. Right? And at least my view is when someone goes and makes accusations against someone, you check the accusations turn out to be wrong. This is a reason to distrust the person who was making the accusations and increase your trust in the person who was accused. You know, so if someone makes an accusation against someone, and then he was cheating, and then you check it, he wasn't cheating. It's first of all a reason to distrust the person who made the accusation of cheating. Second of all is a reason to actually give more trust to the person who was falsely accused. Okay, so how much time do I have?
Probably about
5 minutes. 5 minutes. Okay, great. I will do the quick 5-minute version of the end. All right, now, one thing about economists is that they really are people who hear that something is possible, is true in fact, and they ask, yeah, but how is that possible in theory? Okay, so when I present these rules to economists, they often say, all right, yeah, those are facts, but are they possible? All right? And you can laugh, but on the other hand, if you were to go and bring a helium balloon to a physicist and say, explain that, I think he would have an explanation. He said, I thought your theory says that things fall towards the Earth, but this helium balloon is going away. Physics is wrong. He may say, no, you've misunderstood the physics. I'm sorry. Let me try to explain again, or for the first time. Okay, so in general, when you have a theory that has explained a lot of other things, the fact that you found some counterexamples is actually a reason to wonder what's really going on. Okay. Now, when I go to economists with the right results, they have a standard story that they often use, which you may have heard of, and it's called rational ignorance. It basically says, look, people, there isn't really anything in it for the individual to learn about these things, and so they don't. Okay, that sounds okay, but it has some big problems. Right? So one big one is this. Rational ignorance does not explain why the uninformed have strong opinions rather than merely being agnostic. Okay, so I haven't studied much about the history of ancient Sumeria, so I have no opinions about ancient Sumeria. If you went and told me that it was a matriarchy led by three people who wore funny hats, and you had actually studied it, I wouldn't call you a liar. I'd say, oh, all right, I guess. Right? And yet, economics is a subject where even people who will say, look, I don't know much about this, but, and then go into a 20-minute speech. That's pretty weird. And this is true not just about economics, but it's true about politics in general. How often is a person who is really basically foaming at the mouth on an internet website, and yet if you were to quiz them on basic facts, they don't really know a lot of basic facts. In fact, very limited knowledge of facts. Right? So you think, look, you know so little, why aren't you agnostic? And yet many people are not. Okay? So that's kind of strange. Similar thing is rational ignorance does not explain why people would get emotional about the issues. Right? And yet, you may have noticed that people get emotional about politics. Right? So if you disagree with someone, they often will get upset at you, even if you're perfectly nice. Right? So, in fact, an experiment which my lawyer tells me not to advise people to try, but you could try it hypothetically, is just to go to a meeting of people who disagree with you to an extreme degree, and then as nicely as possible explain why you disagree and see if you make any friends. Okay, so you may make one friend who says, I respect you for your courage. But on the other hand, you'll probably make a lot of enemies. Say, never return here. Get thee hence from here. We never want to never darken our door again. Okay, so just to give you a example of what I see going on anyway. So in the late 90s, Clinton imposed a tariff on Mexican oranges. Now, if rational ignorance were the story, this would sound like you'd go to someone and say, hey, Clinton just imposed a tariff on Mexican oranges. They say, oh, he did? I didn't know that. Or you might say, what are tariffs? Or where's Mexico? All right. This is not generally the reaction that I got from people who knew very little about economics. Instead, they're more likely to say something like, it's about time that he got tough with the Mexicans on oranges. Those Mexican oranges were destroying our country. The only question is, can we still come back from the brink? Okay, so, yeah, all right, yes. Heavily inspired by my dad, I'll admit. All right, so these problems with rational ignorance inspired my alternative to rational ignorance, which I call rational irrationality. The question that I'm trying to answer here is this. Why do people be rational some of the time and irrational other times? My dad. If I were stuck on a desert island with one person, I'd probably pick him because he's an electrical engineer and he would know how to get me home. And he could do a good job. And he would not allow his emotions to carry him away on what building materials we should use for the raft. Okay, so in those areas, extremely reasonable. But on the other hand, get to a subject where he basically knows nothing, and he will give me a long and angry lecture about how the world really works. Okay, so my answer here is we can think about irrationality as being a good like any other. It is a good that you use to protect comforting beliefs from reality. Right? So here's the thing. If you're rational, then your beliefs are always on the chopping block. Some new evidence can come along and show that you're wrong. But if you're irrational, then you never have to change your mind ever again. Right? You can continue to believe whatever it is you believe, and whatever facts come along, you don't have to listen. Okay. Now, when you think about it a bit more, what's interesting is there are some beliefs where having false beliefs can be very costly to you. Like, suppose that you were a surgeon, and you say, I'm such a fantastic surgeon, I'm better drunk than other surgeons are sober. All right, that is a very costly belief. On the one hand, it's emotionally gratifying. On the other hand, you are going to ruin your life and your career if you have that belief. Okay, so that is one where, on the one hand, you might be tempted to be rational, but it's very costly. So you probably are not going to be so rational on that. On the other hand, there's many other beliefs where the cost of rationality is extremely low or basically zero. So what practical difference does it make for your real life if you don't believe in evolution? As long as you're not going to be a biologist or something, you can live your whole life perfectly fine thinking that the human race is 6,000 years old. Right? And you live your day, you live out your life in perfect, blissful harmony, making money, doing whatever it is you want to do, won't make any difference. Okay? Or similarly, what practical difference does it make if someone does not understand the benefits of international trade? My dad's been successful in business despite having no understanding of this. Okay? It just doesn't matter that much. It matters in terms of your private life. It makes a big difference if you want to evaluate social policy. But in terms of getting through your day, you don't really need to know this stuff. Okay? So really, rather than being inconsistent with economic theory, economists should actually expect people to have crazy beliefs about subjects like this. People should expect people to have crazy beliefs on subjects where there's some emotional appeal to having one view rather than another, and where the cost of being wrong is really low. Okay? And so it's not just an ad hoc exception. Economics and politics is one topic on a long list that includes religion, philosophy, a lot of science, so on. These are all areas where people often get emotionally attached to one conclusion. They may not have studied it very well, but they know what they know. Right? And they've got the answers, whether or not, don't confuse me with the facts. Okay, so now why exactly is this so bad? What is bad about this? So one thing you might say is, well, look, all you're saying, Brian, is that politics isn't really about getting wise policy. It's basically like a giant group therapy session where we all get together and we feel good about ourselves. And that's the point of politics. Okay, well, that sounds good, except there's one problem, which is this. On the one hand, it's true people are getting this benefit out of feeling good about themselves from having these irrational views. The problem, though, is that other people wind up picking up the price tag. So if irrational views about policy are widespread, then those policies are actually likely to be adopted by politicians who want to win. Right? Because what do politicians say in order to win? They tell you what you want to hear. So if most people want to hear that a Berlin Wall at the Mexican border is a good idea, then politicians will say that and have an incentive to do it. Right? And even though the result may be that the actual policy has very bad consequences. Right? So it really is very similar to another problem that economists have thought about quite a bit, which is pollution. Right? So in the case of pollution, on the one hand, is it in your individual self-interest to drive a car? Would it be a selfish act for you to say, I'm not going to drive a car because I don't want to poison myself any longer? Probably not, because here's the thing. You're only making a very, very tiny difference to the quality of the environment. And on the other hand, when you drive a car, you get a big increase in convenience. Okay? So this is a case of what economists say that there's big private benefits to you of doing it, and then there's a social cost, which is multiplied out over millions and millions of people. Well, really, it's the same thing with politics. On the one hand, when you have an irrational belief, you may feel better about yourself. However, it also increases the chance that the entire country is going to have to live under that bad policy. Okay, so I will stop it there. Okay.
Thank you. The snapping is a tradition in the society. Regular members snap instead of clapping to show approval. So snapping was a good thing.
All right. Yeah, I was wondering if the snapping is like the Toastmasters where you clap when someone says, aw.
We're going to move into a Q&A session now, so if anybody wrote down a question or thought of anything during the speech, feel free to ask.
Sure, in the front.
Hi. So much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Class.
All right, great.
I'm so glad I did.
All right.
You were talking about the IQ political test. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I was just wondering,
Feel free. The answer is very, very small effect, although it is true the Republicans get a little bit higher on these tests. However, that is not controlling for a lot of other factors. So don't pat yourself on the back too quickly. Yes, in the back. Like, how do you individually self-correct, or how do we fix the problem, or? That sounds like a good idea to me. And there's plenty of stuff that is much more useless than economics that you could cut out and fill the time. There's a number of things to say about your question. So, in terms of what could be done? Well, the very simplest, lowest effort thing that could be done, right, is just to convince people that if they don't know something about a subject, they shouldn't have beliefs about it. So if you haven't studied a subject, be agnostic. Because if people did this, then the miracle of aggregation would work and we'd be fine. And this does not take a lot of effort on people's part. All it takes is honesty and humility to be able to look in front of a mirror and say, you know what, I've never studied economics, I don't understand it, it's hard, I will not base my vote upon anything that people say about economics. So that is in fact the easiest thing to do in terms of how much effort it would require. Right? So this doesn't require anyone to get a PhD in a subject that they aren't even interested in. It just requires some kind of basic intellectual honesty. Of course, basic intellectual honesty is rarely observed. So in terms of other things you could do, improving economic education, that sounds good. I also try to put some burden on my fellow economists and say, let's try to improve our communication skills. Right, so Ken Elsinger has won many prizes for the excellence of his teaching. However, most of us have not won any prizes for the excellence of our teaching. In fact, even if they were giving out a lot more prizes, we would not be winning very many of them. So yes, if you've seen economists on TV, you may notice they're often very boring. And also, when they have 30 seconds to talk, they don't give you any clear answer. So I've been encouraging economists to try to give a clearer answer when they have 30 seconds to talk. Something else that could be done. Yes, over there. Okay. Yeah. So let's just consider me generically thanked by everyone. Now, so you know, no one needs to thank me again. Yes. There's
except. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, just to follow up on the previous question, is it the logical conclusion of your argument then that we should that we're really looking at decreasing franchise, decreasing suffrage substantially based on? Mm-hmm.
So I talk about this in the last chapter of the book. So one very basic point is this. Encouraging people to vote who don't know anything is silly. Right? If someone doesn't know what they're doing, saying they should go vote anyway is... it's very hard. Why would you want them to do that? Right? So if you're a bunch of people standing around talking about what kind of surgery we should do, we say, it doesn't matter where you cut, just cut. In terms of what kind of contribution someone is making to the quality of policy, say, look, if someone can be honest and say, look, I don't know what's going on, so I shouldn't participate, that is something that we should encourage rather than discouraging, as we do now. So in the book, I talk, I have some further discussion about about changes you could make in order to improve the quality of policy. Now here in the book, I distinguish between two different kinds of possible changes. There's the ones that suffer from a catch-22 and the ones that don't. Okay, so things that suffer from a catch-22 would be things like saying that you need to have a test of your competence in order to vote. Okay, so on the one hand, I think that could be an improvement if tried. However, it's almost certainly not going to be tried because you'd have to convince the majority didn't know what it was doing. And that's really hard to do. Okay, so So I mean, it's something where in principle it could be fine, but in practice I don't see anything like that happening. So even though every time I'm on the radio people hone in on that paragraph and ask me about it, it's not really all that interesting. In terms of, you know, other things that can be done, you know, improving the quality of economic education, improving persuasion, and again, you know, just changing our attitudes towards people who participate without knowing what they're doing. Right? So rather than saying, you know, it's an awful person who doesn't participate, we say it's an awful person who participates without knowing what they're doing. Let's see. Yes, over there.
You spoke about these political aptitude tests, or aptitude tests, and the questions seem very technical. And I assume they'd be very technical for economics tests of the same. But there are people who may not have a technical terminology understanding of economics, but they experience economics every single day. So they could possibly score low on the test, like the average small business worker or something like that. So they might not technically know a lot about economics, but they understand the practice of it.
Yeah, I think it is much less valuable, actually. Honestly, I mean, the thing that you learn in practical daily life is how to do your job well. What you do not learn is things like assessing overall social costs and benefits. Almost no one has a job like that. Okay, so auto worker may very well understand that Japanese cars are hurting my industry, so that's bad. However, what he's much less likely to have any appreciation of is, look, are there any benefits of international trade? What is actually a best trade policy overall? Okay, so, an important thing to realize is that while we think about, we were talking about this very question at dinner. While we do like to have this idea that someone could go and work in one subject and they could study that subject and then they'll figure out something in a totally different field, that almost never happens. Right? So in theory, it's possible that you could study history and then from this you could reach great insight about economics, but almost no one can do that. Most learning is very specific. So if you study one, learn a lot about one subject, it is unlikely to raise your grade in any of the other subjects that you're studying, unless the subjects are really closely connected, like calculus one and calculus two, right? Or say, Latin and French, maybe, right? But in general, most learning is highly specific. So the fact that someone has a very good understanding of how their business works doesn't really give them much qualification to understand economic policy or other issues. Yes, in the front, please.
Though I fully can see that having talked to many voters, most of them are perhaps not economics PhDs, to be sure. I also might note that the system of rule by philosopher king is one long, just kind of shoved under the rug. Are the consequences of having the 10 or 20 smartest people, maybe a few Milton Friedmans, ruling the country significant? Are those benefits significant enough to overweight the costs of essentially disenfranchising a large portion of the populace? Specifically, I'm referring to, is the economic feasibility of a policy the only measure of its value? In the United States, we generally value the civil right to vote, for example. It seems like your theory is leading against that.
All right, so very good question. So one important thing to realize is that democracy is a continuum. For example, Britain is much more democratic than the U.S. In Britain, if you get a majority, you can do whatever you want, right, without limit. Right? On the other hand, in the U.S., there are many restrictions on what majorities can do. So all that I'm really arguing for is some additional movement away from what they do in Britain. And in fact, on page 3 of the book, I talk about the evils of dictatorship. And just say, look, we all know the evils of dictatorship. We don't need to belabor them any further because there are so few defenders of them. Now, in terms of whether the benefits of putting everything in the hands of 20 philosopher kings would be worth it, maybe not. However, the benefits of moving, say, 20 percentage points in that direction, on the other hand, could very well be substantial. And here's a way of thinking about it. So if you go and compare the economic growth rates of countries with the best economic policy to more mediocre policy, a lot of times that can mean a difference of one extra percentage point of growth per year, which might not seem like very much, although when you compound that over the course of a century, that is an enormous difference. Right? That is an enormous difference. And when you go and look at countries that are doing even worse, then it really is it is the difference between China remaining stuck in the horrible poverty that it had 30 years ago and the China that we have today. So, you're certainly right that people will say they greatly value the civil right to vote. Although, in terms of, let me put it this way. Suppose you got an offer to go and work in Canada. How much extra would the Canadian firm have to pay you to make you perfectly happy to live in Canada and have no say over their government there? I don't think it really is that much. This is the kind of thing where you're supposed to say that you value the right very intensely, and yet, in fact, people don't actually value it all that much. In fact, if you happen to miss election day, you'd probably be much less upset with yourself than if you lock your keys in the car.